So while this is booting up, just to tell you about this C-Care. Well, actually, there's a couple things. So this Project Compassion, it's actually a neurosurgeon who's not a Buddhist, not a meditator, not even necessarily religious or anything. But he had experiences doing surgery on a friend that were that really compelled him to think about. And he also made lots and lots of money. I think he was involved in making the Gamma Knife for surgery. Neural brain surgery, and he made a lot of money, lost a lot of money, gave a lot of money, but he basically was like, you know, I'm going to die soon. I'd really like to do something more than just make money. And so he and other people are funding this project, but they brought the idea to His Holiness the Dalai Lama up in Seattle last spring, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama took out his checkbook, and he said, I will help you in person. So he's coming next year, and he's took out his checkbook and wrote a check for $150,000. And he said, here's the first donation, which is pretty wild. So we have a feeling, a sense of responsibility. So they just sponsored four projects. One is mine, or one is one that I proposed, on training medical students and physicians in being more empathic in their communication with patients. And so we're actually going to do a training and seeing how much we can, because actually there's research showing that from first year of medical school through the fourth, I don't know if there are any physicians in the room, from first to fourth year and then even into residency, the level of care and compassion goes down. But also kind of by necessity, because the emotions, especially in certain fields, are so intense that it's too much to deal with. So that's something that we're going to try to counter. And fortunately, I found two MDs who are faculty at Stanford Medical School who are directly involved in the curricula. And they both were totally gung-ho for us to come and do some compassion cultivation training and communication training. So hopefully... And we still have no image. Well, we can always do a plan B. Well, we could do, if we don't work that, I can actually tell you. We can actually go back to old-fashioned days when you didn't have to worry about visuals so much. So let me give you the punchline, which actually is a good way to start, and then we can unpack it. So I'll tell it in a story first. So there's a wonderful clinical psychologist, researcher, clinical scientist named Zindel Siegel. So actually, there's a threesome. Zindel Siegel, University of Toronto, Mark Williams, and John Teasdale from Oxford and Cambridge. So the three of them are superstar cognitive behavioral, traditional, empirical, cognitive behavioral therapists. And cognitive behavioral therapy, I don't know how many mental health clinicians there are in the field, in the room right now, but is the gold standard in terms of psychotherapies for empirically supported or validated treatments for different kinds of problems, anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive, etc. So these guys are focused on major depression. And major depression has the second highest rate of prevalence in amongst adults after alcohol and substance abuse. So social anxiety is third. And essentially, they're very interested in cognitive processing, what's called information processing. When you do reaction time tasks and looking at like emotional stimuli, faces, et cetera, what are the cognitive processes that are going on that are creating vulnerability or resilience to developing major depression? And just to be clear, major depression, for those who don't know, there are 9 specific symptoms in the manual that we use. And a person has to have at least 2 weeks or longer, every single day, a major shift in depressed mood, sadness, and also anhedonia, a lack of ability to experience pleasure in things that normally would bring pleasure, plus at least 3 other symptoms, so you have 5 in total out of 9. That's one thing. But essentially, they were like, great, cognitive behavioral therapy is very good for treatment for major depression. But we know that if you've had one major depressive episode, right, not just feeling sad for a couple days, but a real clinical major depressive episode, the likelihood of experiencing another clinical depression is 50%. If you've had 2 or more major depressive episodes, the likelihood is 70 to 80% that that you're going to have another. So there's really something about major depression that is recurrent, that there's a residual vulnerability that leads to relapse. So these three wonderful thinkers, clinicians, therapists were thinking, what can we do? What can we introduce as a relapse prevention? And they somehow got interested in meditation practice. And there are many, many kinds of meditation practice. One in particular, mindfulness meditation. In Sanskrit, smriti, in Tibetan, temba, and it means to remember. Actually, it means bringing to mind's attention. So it's really based in memory, remembering to stay in the moment, to be aware of what's happening right now, as opposed to future tripping, past tripping, instead being in the present. So they actually were very curious. They took some meditation courses, and they began to think, well, what is it about depression? So we know that, and everyone here knows, right? So if my partner dies, if my child dies, if I have incredible loss in the moment, a very powerful life event, that could be a cause to go into grief and perhaps even into major depression. That's one type, that's one source. A whole other source is having, and you can check this out right now in your mind, having a mind that tends to slip into, very quickly, perhaps even automatically, a negative filter. Specifically, I suck. People suck. The world sucks. I'm never going to be good enough. I'm too fat. I'm not smart enough. I'm not as good as other people. I am bleh. So people range on a continuum on how quickly they slip into this negative self-focused rumination, negative self-denigration belief. That is a very powerful predictor of who will experience major depression, who will relapse, and who, in the face of difficult life events, loss of a job, loss of a partner, maybe moving away from all your friends, that life event, in combination with this cognitive, this distortion in thinking that serves as a vulnerability to slipping into depression, the interaction of life event and that thinking style, negative self-focused rumination, can lead to subsequent major depression. So Zindel Siegel did a fantastic study, very simple, get people with major depression, treat them with SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, Luvox, et cetera, treat the other people with cognitive behavioral therapy. The people who get better, follow them for 2 years. 2 years later, what do? You give them an emotional disturbance, a sad music, thinking about a very painful event. Those people who took the medication with a very slight negative provocation slipped into a very negative thinking style, dysfunctional attitudes and negative thinking. The people who were treated with cognitive behavioral therapy, somehow, even 2 years later after finishing treatment, they learned something, not just took a drug, they learned something, that's the key thing, that sticks in the mind, that actually helped buffer against this shift into negative self-belief when faced with an emotional probe. So that was a very important clue. Fast forward, they did meditation retreats. They tried to think about what is actually happening with mindfulness meditation, the ability to shift attention, the intention to become more aware of what's happening in the mind-body stream, and to regulate, to become more emotionally aware and more aware of how my mind works. That they then incorporated into cognitive behavioral therapy, those mindfulness techniques, and called it mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. As a not a treatment for major depression, a treatment to prevent relapse back into major depression, which is one of the key things when you're working with somebody. Because major depression in and of itself, maybe people here know, even if it goes untreated, people sometimes actually do have spontaneous recovery or recover over time. But is there something that we can do to help decenter the person, me, from my certain quality of thoughts, negative self-focused rumination, so that if I have that tendency to spin, even if somebody at work doesn't look at me the right way or my boss says something and I misinterpret, spinning into this, cascading into these negative beliefs, is there a way to kind of loosen up the grip? So now just check out your own experience. doing meditation practice, does it lead to feeling that the thoughts, images, this view of self becomes more loosened, or does it become more sticky? Sticky mind, Teflon mind. Sticky pan that you put eggs in, or Teflon-coated mind, so that anything that goes in, there's less friction, there's less sticky, and it can move in, and it can move out. So any good chef knows you want a lot of butter and you want a good Teflon pan. So you can put anything in there, make a beautiful omelet, and likewise, no, just think about it. What is really the source? You can just think about it. In your own mind, what if you get really real right now? You wake up this morning, you wake up tomorrow morning, what's the thing that causes the most suffering? Is it the partner? Is it the food? The money? The lack of money? A nice house? Not enough windows? Not enough nice view? No. You wake up in the morning, what happens? We beat ourselves up. Does anybody disagree? What do? I'm not good enough, I'm not this enough, I'm a blah, 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 blah. It's our own habit. When you were 2 months old, when you were 2 years old, when you were 3 years old, did you have this cascading, this tendency to spin into negative self-beliefs? And anger is just the external manifestation. Instead of focusing on me, it's like, oh, that person sucks, this person, the boss sucks, that person sucks, blah, blah. It's the same, it's just the inverse. So really, one of the most powerful sources of our own suffering, and in fact, Shakyamuni Buddha was a cognitive therapist. If you really get down to it, how do we identify the ways that we think and act, and actions, physical actions come from thinking many times, not always, many times. What are the ways that we think that lead to a cul-de-sac where we are spinning like a whirlpool in our own negative beliefs? Depression, anxiety, anger, loneliness. It's arising from beliefs, thoughts, interpretations. So the extent to which, is there a practice, is there a way of training the mind to loosen up the grip on the content of the mind stream? So even right this moment, silently, in your mind, say your own name. So I say, Philippe, 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 Philippe. Just say your own name. Now say Xander. Repeat the name Xander in your mind. Xander, Xander, Xander. If you did it long enough, is there a different sense of grasping at, oh, that's me, that's me, that's me, oh, that's me. And that's a habit. 2 months old, 6 months old, they don't have it. They may or may not really know that they have a name. So we build up certain habits that are functional. Not that thinking is bad or a feeling is bad, by no means. In fact, just the opposite. It's beautiful when it's not stuck, when the omelet is not stuck in the pan. So just really think about it from your own experience. Is there a way of Teflon coating my mind? So that anything that comes through, I love this person, I hate this person, I suck, I'm wonderful, I'm Philippe, I'm not Philippe, I'm male, I'm not male, I'm this, I'm that. Any thought, anger, fear, jealousy, beautiful, bliss, that anything that crosses the mind stream, literally a stream of experience from moment to moment to moment, is fun and moves and doesn't get stuck. So what is obsessive compulsive disorder? Brain stuck. Dirt. These are dirty. They're dirty. I have to go wash. I can't talk to you. I have to go wash. I can't listen to you. I have to go wash. Or, did I close the door? Did I close the door? Oh my gosh, did I close the door? Did I turn the gas off? Oh my god, da da da. And you can think of any example. The mind gets stuck in a cul-de-sac. The mind gets stuck. And we all have our own manifestation, right? It's totally part of it. So the idea are there practices? Are there specific things that we can do to train the mind, our mind, right this moment, to loosen the stickiness of the monkey mind, to loosen the stickiness, the way that we relate to the content of our awareness, the sensations from my body, pleasant and unpleasant, the thoughts, pleasant and unpleasant, the emotions, pleasant and unpleasant. Actually, in fact, from the mindfulness perspective, the content doesn't matter at all. It's the process of how I grasp, hold, reify, concretize, or loosen, or see any moment, even right this moment, the word, sound, shape, beginning, middle, end. Projection on what that word means. So how do we actually relate to our ongoing current experience in a way that is more free? Right? So really, what was the Shakyamuni talking about? Freedom. Mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, all these other labels, blah, blah, blah. The real deal is, what's the source of suffering? How do I relate to my suffering? Don't worry about others. Everyone's got to take care of it themselves. And how do I take responsibility? If I've developed the habit of being really negative towards myself, negative towards others, incredibly evaluative, judgmental, join the club, everybody does it, what now do I do? Are you doing meditation practices? Am I doing meditation practice? Am I doing any skill that loosens the tenacity, the tendency to grasp a thought as if it were real? So, for example, thought experiment. From this moment on, say you took a different name. And when people called your new name, initially it would be really weird, and then it would become more and more familiar, and then it would become automatic. Say you identify as a female, or as a male, or as something else, and now suddenly you shift that basis of self-identification. What would that do to how you move through the day? If you currently grasp at the self in a way that is really clear, and you can do an experiment. I've actually done it sometimes. Imagine you ask a couple of friends to just, for example, to say something nasty to you and notice your reactivity. And then you ask them to do it again and you notice how the reactivity changes, becomes less and less potent, less and less real. So can you set up experiments for in yourself to really test the boundaries of how much you grasp at certain ways of viewing the self, certain thoughts, certain habits? So stabilizing the mind through focusing on the breath, mindfulness skills, which is a whole set of things, these are techniques for developing the skill to begin to probe what we do to ourselves. In the example of major depression, we know that there's the triad of distorted thinking. I'm horrible, I suck, the world sucks, and the future is miserable. That's the cognitive triad. That's really stable, distorted ways of thinking in people when they're in a depressive episode. So how do you loosen those grips? How do you teach people skills when they're currently not depressed and their mind is okay, to be able to apply WD-40, for people who weren't here last week, one analogy of the effect of mindfulness is like WD-40. Where there is grit and stickiness and habitual tendency to grasp, can you spray a quality into the brain, into the mind, to loosen it up? And then what I would ask you to all ask yourself, what really is the limit of how much I can decenter from the thoughts, the sensations, and the emotions, which from moment to moment, both conscious and not conscious, we continuously grasp at self, me, on the basis of the thoughts, the sensations, and the emotions. What would it be like to wake up tomorrow morning and loosen that a little bit, and then loosen it even more? And it doesn't mean losing who you are and what you do and what you do and who you are. It means being able to move through the day more fluidly. I mean, really, if you think about what's the goal of the practice? Why are you practicing? What's the goal of the practice? What skills are necessary to go deeper into your own mind? Because that's exactly where it's at. And it's not happening externally. That's why they call it search inside yourself, because we spend so much time looking outside, externally, at ads, at other people, at mirrors. What would it be like? So it's actually quite radical if you think about it. Drop all the crap on the outside. What's happening here? And then the other big thing, especially in terms of major depression and in terms of we lay people, right, not monks, but even monks and nuns have relationships, not sexual, is how does this all play out interpersonally? That's a very important thing too, because we know that when a person in a couple has major depression, the partner, the children, the parents, the friends, who don't have major depression or anxiety, get really burned out. The most extreme example of that is caretakers of someone who is ill. So you can think of the most severe, like Alzheimer's dementia. The rates of major depression in the general public, about 16%. Twice as much in women than men. That's a whole other discussion. Caretakers of somebody who's really chronically ill, it's about 50%. And as we all live longer, what are we going to face? More time as caretakers. So this is actually a pretty important issue if 50% of caretakers are going to develop major depression and be unidentified and often untreated. So it behooves us to become more and more enlightened for our own well-being and for the well-being of everyone around us. Because if I get depressed and my mom is really going to be unhappy, my wife is going to be pretty miserable, my six-month-old daughter, my friends, my lab mates, everybody. So really think about it in terms of taking, what can I learn to take optimal care of myself for my own benefit, but also for the benefit of everyone around me. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is a hybrid to try to introduce mindfulness skills in the context of cognitive therapy. And two huge clinical trials, which is the research methodology that we use to evaluate whether a given training or treatment is effective, and for whom, and for how long. Three different countries replicated the same finding. The finding is the following. Ready? I want you to think about this. For people with three or more previous major depressive episodes, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy very effective in reducing by half the rate of subsequent relapse into another major depressive episode, both compared to SSRIs and treatment as usual. For people with two, one previous episodes, not helpful. Yeah, replicated in big samples, so like, 100 people across three different countries. So it's not a New Jersey thing, right? Or a Palo Alto thing. It's in three different countries and replicated. And replication in big studies is the key thing for really relying on science. Don't rely on one study or one article, blah, 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 blah. Forget about it. So why three or more previous major depressive episodes, those people who have three or more episodes of depression benefited in terms of prevention of subsequent relapse? There are a couple of hypotheses. There is what's called the scarring hypothesis, which comes from brain activation, brain data, where researchers have suggested that if the more major depressive episodes, which really are really stressful, think about post-traumatic stress disorder, which really is really concurrent with major depression and sleep disorders. Each major depressive episode, the hypothesis says, scars, and I don't know if I like that word, but scars brain mechanisms to make it more dysfunctional and more vulnerable to minor or major life events, ways of thinking, that then predispose that person to another major depressive episode. So one idea is that you need multiple major depressive episodes three or more times, you actually are kind of locking into a certain brain system that then becomes amenable to something like mindfulness. This notion that there are treatments that help people who have more severe or more disturbed, if you want to call it, ways of thinking and brain mechanisms. So this is just a hypothesis that's been thrown out, and people don't really understand why this is the case. But having said that, I want to go back to how I started, which is that both in neuroscience, neurology, pediatric, adult, all of the mental health care fields, be it psychiatry, clinical psychology, social workers, psychiatric nurses, marriage, family therapists, there's an explosion of interest in bringing Eastern techniques of meditation, acceptance, Eastern perspectives, figuring out how do we fuse that with Western traditions of psychological well-being and into our therapeutic techniques to work with couples, individuals, groups, even Google institutions.
Then why waste your time on anyone who hasn't had 3 episodes?
That's an interesting question. For major depression, yes. For anxiety disorders, it's a totally different thing. In fact, the research there, there's nothing about number of episodes. But for major depression, it's a good question. We don't have an answer yet. The other thing that we have to be careful is, well, I mean, there are many questions. How do you really integrate? And what is like, so right, you know, I walked in the room, all of you were sitting. What were you actually doing? What were you actually training? Were you training neural networks that have to do with attention? Were you training in, oh, I'm noticing these thoughts, da da da, but I'm bringing my attention back to the breath or to the belly? I don't know what you were doing. What is the effect of that type of training? And then, as healthcare workers, we grasp at techniques and want to give them because we think they're good. But that's why the research is so important, to figure out, well, above and beyond my own opinion and inclination and yearning, what actually is beneficial and for whom. So one of the things is, for people who have this habitual tendency to spin into negative self-focused beliefs, and you can measure that with a questionnaire, it's very simple, kind of simple, those are the ones who benefit most from mindfulness-based training. Sir? There, in terms of the research, it's helping to prevent relapse into major depression. In terms of what people yearn to do is to treat depression, which is why I want to be really clear. Does anyone here know of any meditation technique which is a treatment for major depression? No. In fact, did the Buddha show me one sutra where that was the case? No. Buddhist practice really comes from a stable enough mind to recognize the current world is not really okay, and I want to do more. So the Buddha was not talking about people with anxiety disorders and depression. Fast forward 2,500 years, here we are, clinicians, psychiatrists, social workers. We want to provide things that we believe are beneficial and give them, but we need to do it skillfully, carefully, and be aware that when a person is in a current major depressive episode, and I get calls all the time, that is not, the current data does not support telling that person to do, you know, retreats or to focus on the self. Now, my self sucks. That's the last thing I want to look at. So really, we have to be more skillful, right, Upaya? We have to be very skillful and honest and genuine. There are 84,000 techniques that Shakyamuni taught, Shakyamuni Buddha, because there are huge individual differences in people. And there are also individual differences in my mental state when I'm on caffeine, or sleep deprived, or blissed out, or sad, or very anxious. And I need to learn which techniques and methods work for whom, especially for me, because this is the research laboratory, right? So, not a treatment for major depression, but helping people learn skills to bring in that WD-40, that psychological flexibility that goes, oh my gosh, I'm seeing that I'm thinking more negatively. Or I'm searching for a partner. I think about all the people who, and I'm not part of that, who go online and then who like have these blind dates with these people to start seeing if they can find a partner. Talk about exposure. Oh my gosh. You go out there and like, oh my gosh, I wonder if she likes me. Gosh, I wonder thinks I'm blah, 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 blah. I mean, the cascade of things. I wonder how much, if we could measure, we could go inside, how much of the time on a date, say a dinner date, am I thinking about myself or am I really taking in the other person? I wonder if we measure that. And so this might be a very interesting litmus test to see how much I'm so self-absorbed or self-concerned or self-worried. And we know when you're in a major depressive episode, you know, the outside world just disappears. It's just me and I suck and I'm just going to fall apart and everything is blah, 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 blah. It's when it gets heavy. So the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is being used right now for everything, in fact. People are trying to apply it for everything, but the research data is not there. So I really encourage you, as a practitioner and a scientist, be skeptical, be critical, really rely on meta-analyses, not just a paper published in the Tuesday Science magazine or Science you know, or ABC News. We want replication, and we want large sample sizes, meta-analyses, and studies done in different labs, not four studies done from the same lab, to really try to figure out, does this help this particular technique? So, for example, one study was done on the body scan. People here know the body scan, right? So that's one type of technique to focus attention, to notice sensation arising, changing, impermanence, dissolving, letting go. Or, I don't feel anything. I'm bored. Nothing's happening. To notice that. So that body scan was done compared to a standard relaxation, what's called progressive muscle relaxation, which is a whole series of tightening and loosening, which is really helpful for reducing anxiety. The body scan was shown to be very effective. That was one study, but it was very interesting to take one particular practice compared to a psychological-based practice and see how it compares. But you had a question, sir.
I just had a question on last week. Are there similar brain imaging studies looking at depression as you had last
week? Yes, so in fact, yeah, there are a lot of studies on both bipolar depression, right, manic depressive disorder, which is very, very different from major depression. Those are the two main kinds. And there are many brain imaging studies, and people are trying to figure out what's happening in the brain, both when the person is just in a resting state, so you would look at metabolic processes in the brain, also when you do an experimental task where you probe emotionally or cognitively the person's brain. So there are many brain imaging studies. And in fact, every week. And trying to let, so there's a whole movement. There's self-report, like, what do you feel, sleep? I feel depressed. I can't sleep. Blah, blah, blah. There's also the brain imaging, which is going under the skull to kind of let the brain speak for itself. When you ask a person to focus on a really sad situation in your life, in my life, does a person begin to cry? Well, that's really observable. In fact, we have done that. My wife did it for her dissertation, Vivica. She actually did a autobiographical script inside the MRI machine as a self-generated, personally salient probe of people with major depression. So she took people who are currently fine, but they had three or more depressive episodes in the past, and currently fine, and asked them to focus on themselves. Both positive qualities, confident, able, strong, also negative qualities like sad, low, unstable, blah, blah, blah. Then she did this self-generated script of sad situations, then brain imaged them again, and literally saw how the, even for 8 minutes with really sad music playing at half speed, and research is funny, with your own autobiographical script, some people actually started crying. Remembering painful autobiographical situations with the sad music, and then you do the same exact task as they did just a few minutes ago. The brain activity is different in the people with past major depression versus the people with no history of anxiety, depression, nothing. So a lot of depends on the experimental design to try to probe specific sources of vulnerability. And in that way, I like the metaphor of letting the brain speak for itself, because we know that self-report is not always accurate, but the brain sometimes can show us things that people don't self-report. Having said that, in terms of treatment, just to be honest, in terms of treatment, because I was just reading about it, there are many new kinds of brain stimulation techniques for major depression. This is for the most intractable. So SSRIs are very helpful for many people, not for everyone, but for people who are really not responding to medications, perhaps even not to cognitive behavioral therapy, which is really, really good and not invasive for major depression. There is deep brain stimulation, electrical stimulation in an area that's called the subgenual anterior cingulate. It's here and back. I just finished a paper last night where I was talking about that in terms of anxiety, but in terms of hopefulness, rather. But that's an area where they're currently doing direct electrical stimulation. And a friend of mine does it, Helen Mayberg, fantastic researcher, neurologist. And in the worst cases, that is shown some help. The key, the punchline there is that this particular area, the anterior cingulate, the subgenual, the bottom of it, seems to be very important in coordinating emotion-related brain regions and thinking, self-related regions. And it seems to help reset the integration and communication. Because we know that, be it anxiety or depression, when emotion becomes super intense, the limbic and paralimbic, which is a whole set of brain regions that are kind of in the ventral part of the brain, I call it limbic override, where anxiety or depression becomes so intense that it overrides signals that would normally go to shift your attention, Philippe, think positively, call a friend, go to the museum, go to the De Young Museum, go play sports, blah, 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 all these other things. Limbic override, where the intensity becomes so strong, it overrides the ability to use other brain systems that normally would help regulate emotion. So this is why meditation, where you become more and more intimate with how your mind works, and being able to identify even subtle shifts in emotion, thinking, reactivity, the more and more subtle you can become, the more you can take responsibility. Like, ooh, look at that, I'm more negative today. Okay, let me take that as information to then respond differently, or even just to be aware that I'm more vulnerable. So maybe that day I take care of myself in a different way. So one of the things that meditation can do is make you more and more aware, responsible, skillful. So I hope that you don't listen to my words, but actually experience it in yourself. If you can do that, that's probably the most powerful thing you can do. And that's actually what Shakyamuni Buddha was about. Check it out, test it in many different situations. Test it in your own experience. See if this really, really works or not. Not bullshit. Forget the bullshit. I'm going to be dead really soon, so might as well use this precious human rebirth to do something real, right? So I just want to, there was a hand here. Trauma meaning post-traumatic stress disorder, like sexual abuse, car accidents, war. Yeah, so thank you for bringing that up. So people are really interested in the question, does mindfulness, which is one technique, or other types of techniques of meditation, does that work for people with post-traumatic stress disorder, with intense trauma? The data so far, not so good. We can really understand why. A person with post-traumatic stress disorder has hyper-emotional arousal, hyper-vigilant, emotionally reactive, thought intrusions, and often has lots of depression and lots of sleep problems. So in that mode, when currently depressed, meditation has not been shown to be helpful. Different kinds of meditation. What is really helpful for depression can be behavioral activation. Go out to the De Young, go exercise, kiss your partner, get out of the house, go into the light. Cognitive, work on, oh my gosh, look at those ways that I'm thinking. Oh my gosh, is that real or not? Is that helpful or not? Is that distorted? Test, oh my gosh, I think that I have no friends. But wait a second, two people called me yesterday. Oh, wow, my thinking is really negative and not in touch with reality. Cognitive challenging. Those things tend to be much more helpful. And in fact, the single best, most empirically supported intervention for trauma is exposure therapy, which you have to do with a very trained clinician. Most clinicians right now, even PhD clinical psychologists, are not trained in exposure. We're doing it now for social anxiety, which is very different from post-traumatic stress disorder. There are very few people trained in doing it really, really well. The best place here is at the Palo Alto VA. They have an outpatient and inpatient post-traumatic stress disorders clinic for women and for men separately. That's the best quality post-traumatic disorder treatment. There's also something called somatic therapy, which I'm not familiar with. There's somebody in Marin or somewhere. I don't know any studies on that, but I know a lot of people do somatic therapy. But exposure is the single most powerful intervention for exposure means graded exposure. So like snake phobia. Philippe has snake phobia. I don't, but if I did, you first expose me in a graded fashion to, here's a picture of a snake. How are you feeling, Philippe? Can you do relaxation? Can you stay with it? Can you approach it? A real snake, et cetera, et cetera. And so you actually do graded exposure, step by step by step, to the object that one fears. So in social anxiety, it could be another person. It could be blood phobia, snake phobia. In post-traumatic stress disorder, it might be, and I did a one-year rotation in PTSD with Vietnam vets. And for them, it was in a moment back in a field with a dead body or about to kill someone, blah, 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 and literally helping them reduce their reactivity to those memories. So.
Just to speak to somatic therapy, I recently had some training.
Good.
And the point of it is that a person re-experiences whatever the trauma was, but slows down their body movements so that they can understand things they might have missed. So an example is a man is driving in a car and has an accident, and he puts his arm out and saves his son from hitting the dashboard, and there's a son in the back seat. But when you slow his arm down while you're working with him, he realizes that he is attending to the one in the back seat that he thought he wasn't attending to, and he releases himself of the guilt of not being able to save the child or whatever.
Slowing down enough to notice what actually happened. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Yeah. Other? There are people doing studies on almost anything you can imagine. Currently in my lab, we're doing, for adults with social anxiety disorder, individual cognitive behavioral therapy, a wellness exercise program. Exercise in and of itself, meta-analyses from the past 40 years have shown, reduces symptoms of stress, anxiety, depression, better sleep, better libido. And then we're also doing standard MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. So right now I'm only studying those three. I'm not looking at medication. But there are people who have been doing studies on Vipassana. And as I said, we're about to do a study on just, it's actually Tibetan Buddhist, a series of five or six different compassion towards self and other meditation practices in a six-week program developed by the Dalai Lama's translator, Thupten Jinpa. And he's a collaborator on the study. So, but there is need. There are many different techniques, and a lot of them have not been studied. But, you know, the standard things are medications, cognitive therapy, interpersonal therapy, dialectic behavior therapy. Oh, boy, there's a lot of them. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. There are a lot of these different somatic therapy. But a lot of them haven't been, some of them have not been empirically tested in randomized clinical trials. That's the gold standard methodology. Anything less than that is mushy. And you just can't really trust. So, sir?
How did the study stack up to medication and placebo?
For which disorder? Which problem?
Depression.
For major depression. from mild to moderate level, major depression, cognitive behavioral therapy, be it individual or group, seems to be equally effective to SSRIs, standard SSRIs for major depression. For the severe major depression, medication's better. Then also the combination. So it seems to be that for immediate treatment effects, the combination doesn't seem to do better. Medication and cognitive behavioral therapy does not seem to do better than one or the other alone. But long-term effects, like 1 or 2 years, I mentioned this study that showed differential response to an emotional probe 2 years after treatment, better for people trained in cognitive therapy than medication. Oh, mindfulness is not a treatment for depression. It's a relapse prevention. It's not a treatment. There is no meditation treatment for depression right now that I'm aware of. No. Zero.
You mentioned mindfulness-based cognitive therapy.
Yeah.
Are people doing this therapy now?
Yes. Yes. There are a few people. Oof, what's her name? Well, I know it's UCSF Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute. There is a MBCT clinic for major depression. The quality of the teachers, I do not know. Because as all of you know, just because somebody is certified in something doesn't mean that they really know it, especially something as subtle as meditation practice. Or even people I know who've, actually Stanford faculty I know, who have PhDs in clinical psychology, and I thank the Lord that they are not seeing patients. Because they're horrible. So there's no such guarantee. I thank the Lord they're researchers and not clinicians. Egomaniacs. Yeah, so the thing is to find people who are really, really solid. How do you find that? This is a huge thing in both training of therapists, like the standard therapists in like in PhD programs, in any program, and also in, there's a whole, like we actually have had discussions about what does it mean to train a meditation teacher? What are the qualities that they should have? What books should they have? What psychology courses should they be aware of? Should they be psychologists? Should, like, how many retreats, et cetera, et cetera. So in fact, in the field right now, how you certify somebody as a teacher, you know, in the old days, it was a master had, he or she had disciples and had direct day-to-day observation of that person's behavior. We don't have that anymore. So this is a major problem. Just because you get a PhD doesn't mean shit. Just because you're an MD doesn't mean you know anything about research. Just because you have done meditation retreat, I know people who've done like 10 years of meditation retreat, and they're much more neurotic than somebody who's... So unfortunately, the direct experience of another person and seeing the reliability of that person from moment to moment to moment to moment to moment. But likewise, don't, and even if you go to a therapist, don't just go to the first therapist. What I always tell people is go see 3-4 different therapists. See if you can get a gut feeling for who would be good, and also ask many, many, many people about that person. Because there is no certification. And unfortunately, my mind is so ignorant, it's very hard to really be clear about who is trustworthy and who's not. I mean, you know, the benefit of the doubt. But so this is a major problem. I mean, we're dealing with it at Google right now. We want to transfer this program from Mountain View to all the Googles around the world, and then from beyond Google. But we need teachers. What do the teachers need to be trained in? You know, like, you know, do you need somebody who knows all the sutras? No. Do you need somebody who's done every kind of meditation technique? No. Should they be psychologists? I don't know. But anyway, other questions? So I'll come back to you, sir.
I'm wondering, in your study, how much mindfulness meditation training is needed to be beneficial?
How much mindfulness meditation training is needed to be beneficial? There are individual differences, but I can tell you this from having led many of them. Roughly, by session 4 or 5, I can sense if a person is getting something or not. There's a lot of body movement and anxiety and discomfort being in a group. By session 4 or 5, sometimes I open my eyes and I look at the people and I can literally see from their body, this thing is in the way, that they are settled in. And that's sometimes that can be the case. Having, you know, in terms of training somebody in meditation, 8 weeks is nothing. I mean, in traditional cultures, you do years and years of training in different kinds of meditation practices. So the 8 sessions, we know, is just a very brief introduction. And we also know that once people stop going to a group, when they're on their own, most people stop meditating because it's really hard to do that kind of behavior to sustain it. So there's no number that says if you do 5 sessions then you got it. Right now, no. You want to comment?
I just want to say that. You're welcome to stay. It is 9 o'clock. So anybody who would like to leave, you're welcome to leave. But please, I'm sure we'd like to.
Sure. Good question. What is mindfulness meditation as opposed to other meditations? So here's a very gross classification. Concentration meditations, where you're developing the muscle to be able to focus the mind. So you could be a chess player focusing on the pattern. You could be a father or a mother focusing on the breath of your 6-month-old. You could be sitting in a small group focusing just on the sensation of the breath. There are many different objects of meditation, but the goal there is to develop the muscle of concentration. Nothing spiritual at all about that. Just a tool. So there are many different techniques for developing single-pointed concentration. Those are non-discursive, no language, logic, anything. Those are concentration. Here's a whole other class of meditations, which are discursive, thinking, analytic, linguistic, where you're actually, like, for example, manifesting anger, noticing what's happening in the body, noticing the causes of anger in this mind stream, the effects, thinking about the are there any positive or negative effects of experiencing anger, rage, experiencing it, observing it, analyzing it, da-da-da-da-da. That's analytic thinking, logic. You want concentration to be able to stay focused on that, but that requires a whole other set of psychological and brain systems. I would suggest, and I'm open to having a healthy discussion, concentration meditations like shamatha, single-pointed focused, all kinds of concentration, and even doing preliminary practices for purification, develop concentration. They also develop, there's also a whole other realm of practices that have to do with devotion. So traditionally, in some traditions, if you're about to start a retreat, the first day, you just do devotion. Devotion to an object of inspiration. To say, here's the target. Here is the blessing. This is what I want to be like. That's a whole other realm. The analytic meditations, in one form, manifests as analytic debate, which I did for 3 years in the courtyards in the monastery. Totally blissful fun. So fun. And when at its best, that is pure concentration and pure analytic, using this incredible analytic ability that human animals have. Language, logic, thinking, perspective taking. That's beneficial for many things. But then all of those, concentration and analytic, have to be combined, especially with compassion, which is a whole other realm, which begins as just a wish. It's not an emotion. I wish that you would be free. I wish that you would understand what totally pisses you off and figure out how not to have that. Just a wish. And then gradually that develops into an emotion. And then it transforms into behavior. But I would argue that all of that is in the service of shunyata, meditation on emptiness. Meditation on the lack of an inherent self is the ultimate form of compassion, and it's the ultimate meditation. And I would suggest that all other meditation preliminary practices, purification, devotion, analytic, concentration, are all tools to be able to sit down and do meditation on emptiness. Because that's actually the... I would suggest that that's the real medicine. Shunyata? Yeah. That's the... Yeah. So one thing that you don't really see books about, maybe there's a little bit. Daniel Goleman has one book on varieties of meditation practices. You know, you think about developmental psychology, you go through all these stages. Somebody needs to write a book on the stages of development through meditation practice, because you don't do one practice for your whole life. You actually go through many different stages of practice, and certain practices you do for a while, then your teacher will say, stop doing that, now do this. Now stop doing that, and now do this. And now do this, because we're changing. And meditation on the lack of an inherent self, which in psychology, it's understanding how my mind projects thingness onto things, cups and human beings, how the mind actually does that. Understanding that process and decomposing it, that's the ultimate form of practice, wisdom and compassion. That's the ultimate form of compassion. If you could do that, you'd serve others, I would say. Does that help? Does that help a little bit?
It doesn't for me.
Fine. That's good.
I guess I thought the question was more like, you know, what exactly is mindfulness meditation compared to others?
Oh, sorry. Oh, mindfulness. I'm sorry. Mindfulness is just mindfulness is just memory. It's a technique. It's actually the Sanskrit word is smriti. It means to remember. There is a sutra on the four different mindfulnesses. There are four different classes of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the corpse, the body, death, impermanence. Mindfulness of the contents of the mind. mindfulness of emotions. And so mindfulness just has to do. It's a quality of the mind. It's actually. In Buddhist psychology, in Abhidharma, they talk mindfulness is one of the ever-present mental factors. That it has to do, the translation is actually to adhere awareness to the object. That's one definition of mindfulness from the Abhidharma. And it has to do with adhering awareness, concentration to an object. And it's developing the capacity to stay focused on an object. It also, in Western parlance, has also kind of gained in this being in the present and also attention regulation. Yeah, so it's only one type of practice, and by no means, I mean, it's just one type. And it's one quality you develop. It's not that, but there are many other qualities that need to be developed. Yeah.
Just following that question, what's the difference between mindfulness and vipassana?
The object of attention, the object, and in fact, there are technical debates in the text. If you want to know, it has to do with what is the object of the meditative mind, the object of, yeah. So in mindfulness, it can be just the mind stream. It could be the corpse. Mindfulness, you pick an object and you just be aware of it. There's also open field meditation, where it's object-less meditation. And the definition of vipassana in the Hinayana and Mahayana schools varies based on what the object of meditation is. So in Hinayana, there are 18 different schools, only one of which continues to exist, the Theravada. And there it has to do with this is more of this adhering the mind to an object. In the Mahayana tradition, the word vipassana, plaktong in Tibetan, insight, superior, has to do with recognizing how things exist. So in Theravada, it's more about impermanence and noticing how you can keep the mind on the object. In the Mahayana tradition, it has a different meaning. The same word has a different meaning. It builds on the other, yeah. Does somebody here had a question? Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, initially it's... Oh, yes. Is there a difference between meditation on emptiness and experience of emptiness? And I would suggest yes. Because in the beginning, do I have compassion for you? No, it's a simulation of. And it's a thinking of, wish for. And there are a whole series of practices that have to do with shunyata, or lack of inherent self, or how the mind projects. And initially, they're more conceptual, and they're external, because it's easier. And then you gradually take on the self, or parts of the self. And it's more conceptual and abstract in the beginning, and then gradually becomes more visceral and less conceptual. Yeah?
Were the meditation practices like loving kindness for self and as projector to others? What does that fit in?
Excuse me, say it again?
Meditation practices like experiencing and projecting loving kindness.
Projecting loving kindness towards others.
And self,
yeah, the two wings of the bird, compassion and wisdom. There are wisdom practices wisdom and compassion practices, and the goal is to then integrate both. You always have both. The goal of becoming more full eventually is self-centered. Begins being by self-centered. I don't want to feel shitty. But then hopefully it starts to expand, and it's actually for the benefit of others. So wisdom and compassion practices are always present. But having said that, there are a lot of practices like mindfulness. You don't have to be spiritual at all. It might lead to a spiritual, but the way it's currently taught in clinics and hospitals and research labs and even in some Buddhist centers or other centers doesn't have to be spiritual. It could be just developing the capacity to adhere the mind. And that has many benefits. And it doesn't have to be in a spiritual context. But in a Buddhist context, wisdom and compassion practices, of which there are many, 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 many kinds, have to be integrated.
Brother named
I do. My brother is Martin. He's a flamenco dancer.
We know each other.
Very good. Yes.
How long
were the participants meditating? Good question. So for the big clinical trials that where they used mindfulness-based cognitive therapy as a relapse prevention training, that was, I think it was 8 2.5-hour sessions once a week. So it was 2 months of training. And that was the dose that was provided for people who had passed major depressive episodes. Yeah.
So in addition to their classes, were they meditating after that?
Yes. They were supposed to be meditating for at least 45 minutes per day with a CD at home during the 2 months. Yeah. Body scan, breath focused, and hatha yoga. I think they didn't do too much hatha yoga in that, but in standard MBSR they do. Yeah.
You know how in mindfulness there's that you're it's really observing, right? You're observing.
Yeah.
So when they do the magnetic resonance, can they see the part of the brain that occurs?
Good question. So using neuroimaging techniques, of which there are many, fMRI or MRI is just one. There's, if you want some acronyms, there's TMS, MEG, EEG, ERP, et cetera, et cetera. These are all neuroimaging, brain imaging techniques. When people become more skillful in mindfulness meditation, is there a specific part of the brain? No. There's not. What we need to do, there's no place where you see the mindfulness. But there are what we rely on are experimental designs and tasks that probe the effect of training in mindfulness. So, for example, some people do self-referential processing, self-focused attention. There's brain imaging studies that have shown changes in the neural architecture that occurs when you're focusing on yourself and how that changes pre-post MBSR. Studies on emotional reactivity or emotional awareness. Or freedom from distraction. These are all different kinds of experimental tasks. Seeing changes in the response or in the emotional awareness in the brain pre-post. So many times we create tasks to assess how different brain systems work, but there's no one single place of mindfulness in the brain. Also, like the self, there is no one place where the self exists in the brain. And in fact, if you think about how the brain has evolved in human animals, or in animals, it's a highly distributed, interconnected system, not dissimilar from our current economic inter-global system. If you think about something happening in Wall Street, totally affecting 15 other places in other countries, it's like that. The brain is currently so super complex, we don't have any good models that capture the complexity. But the brain is, if you try to figure out where things are, it's actually not in a place as much as in the pattern of oscillations across distributed systems. That's beginning to get closer to how the brain encodes and stores information. So it's not a place, but the patterns of across multiple areas. And that's really hard to imagine. But that's actually how the brain, it's closer to how the brain works. And we do a lot of reductionist stuff because our minds are not currently, can't handle the complexity of how the brain has actually evolved over time. It's super beautiful. The thing that's amazing is having neuroimaging tools that allow us to begin to probe that system. That's something that's brand new in the past 20 years. Prior to that, we just did questionnaires and reaction time. And so it's actually a really fascinating time right now. But we really have to think outside the box about how to interpret the results. And that's hard to do right now.
Someone told me that there have been brain studies on monks, and that their happiness centers were amazingly strong or something. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Studies on monks or adepts, there's good and bad news. So one friend of mine at Princeton, they did 50 different tasks with a group of eight adepts with thousands of years of meditation practice. And found very few effects. So out of 50, so just by chance, if you give 50 tasks, you would expect just by chance that a bunch of them would be show that they were much more able, or the brain was showing some signal that was totally different from people with no experience. But think about this. These are not Americans. Many of the tasks that we use, do they have a cultural bias? Even if they're translated into other languages, is there still a cultural bias in the way that science is done? Totally, yes. So this is, did not find differences, only on a couple of things. Now, on the other side, Richie Davidson has brought some adepts to University of Wisconsin-Madison, very small studies, 6, 8 people, blah, 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 which usually we think, you know, that's not very good science, but they have found some effects. The question is replication, and also what does that mean? So, is the cool thing that looking at the brain of a meditator, you can see that they are more free from distraction, or that they can place their attention in a more focused manner? That's interesting. Does it translate into behavior? That in the face of somebody saying, you know, you're an asshole, the person's not reacting. That's starting to get more interesting. That given stuff, they just give it away because they don't hold on to it. So now we're talking about what's really interesting and what's important. So do we need brain imaging to tell us that people who meditate and begin to understand how their mind works and you take responsibility for their emotions, that there's something cool going on? We don't need brain imaging for that, right? Do we know that psychotherapy, in some cases, helps people become less anxious and depressed? You don't need brain imaging for that. The brain imaging is interesting because we can begin to say, what are the neural mechanisms? What's actually changing? What are the mechanisms that would help us know this 70% of people get better from this treatment, but these 30 don't? Can we figure out neurally who will benefit from what? That becomes a public health issue. That becomes more interesting from a public health perspective. Having said that, a colleague of mine at Stanford is going to do a study with Vipassana adepts and people with no meditation experience and try to see how different they are on an economic game and compassion indexed by how willing they are to give money or keep money, which is cute, but I actually don't like those studies. Because is money really the most powerful incentive for connecting with another person? For some people, yes. For other people, no. I think other things. But anyway, they are doing that. So maybe those are Americans, not Easterners. So that might get by the cultural bias thing. So, okay. So thank you. Good questions. Practice, see what happens in the mind. That's the lab, right? Okay.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.